KGVM continues its election season coverage of candidate forums in order to better inform voters. Following is a forum recorded at the Crawford Theater in Bozeman on the evening of May 7th, 2026, featuring Democratic candidates for the U.S. Senate. The candidates were Alani Bankhead, Michael Blackwolf, Michael Hummert, Riley Neal, and Christopher Kehoe, and the moderator was former Montana Supreme Court Justice Mike Wheat.
I'd like to welcome the candidates for U.S. Senate to the stage. And so I'm going to just introduce you by name, and then the format will be each of you will have 2 minutes to make an opening statement before we get into the questions. So first of all, we have Michael Hummert and Alana Bankhead, Michael Blackwolf,
Riley Neal,
and Christopher Kehoe. Michael Blackwolf will make an opening statement. You have 2 minutes.
Well, good evening, everybody. Michael Blackwolf. I'm from Hays, Montana, enrolled member of the Grovon tribe, and I decided to run for United States Senate last August. And what prompted me to get into this race, quite honestly, was my granddaughters. I have 4 granddaughters, and if we kind of saw how things were transpiring and taking place last year with this massive amount of executive orders last January, we saw the pushing and passage of the Big Beautiful Bill, and now we saw the pushing and trying to pass that voting act, and which they got through. Really what they're doing here, ladies and gentlemen, is they're trying to implement Project 2025. And if Project 2025 comes to fruition, there's no room in that world for women, there's no room in that world for minorities, there's no room in that world for Native Americans. My granddaughters check all 3 of them boxes. So that prompted me to get in this race, but not only for my granddaughters, for all minority women, all women in general. So if you're a woman sitting out here, I got in this race for you. One pledge I made last year was if I got into this race, I am in this race to win it, and I'm going to stay in it to the bitter end, and I'm going to do anything and everything that I can to become your next United States Senator. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I just want one clarification here. I said you had 2 minutes. It's actually a minute and a half because there's 5 of you, and that's what we had last time. So, Christopher, you will now have a minute and a half for your opening statement.
Lovely, thank you. Thanks for having us tonight, folks. This is a real pleasure, real honor to be here. Running for Senate in 2026 was not on my bingo card, New Year's Eve. I'm from Minneapolis, and it was the murders of Renee Good and Alex Pretty, and the response of my hometown of Minneapolis that inspired me to get into the race. Now, we're all lovely, fantastic, compassionate citizens here. Y'all saw Americans get shot in the street. I saw neighbors get shot in the street. I saw Second Amendment rights get trampled. I saw local businesses, immigrant-run businesses, be disrupted. I saw neighborhoods being terrorized. I saw hypocrisy. I think we all see this hypocrisy. And for me, this hypocrisy stems out of an executive branch that is not being held to account by the legislative branch, regardless of party. So I'm in this race to bring that core function back to our legislative branch. We've got a really handsome slate of folks up here tonight. And when I say I'm honored, like I'm honored to be before you, I'm honored to be in front of them as well. What animates me and what gives me a lot of hope is that we stand together on like 85 to 90% of the issues. So I'm up here simply offering choice, because the more choice that we have, the more confidence you're going to have going into the primary and the post-primary when we go up against a Republican opponent. Thank you.
Alani?
Well, hello, everybody. It's such an honor to be here with so many patriots. My name is Alani Bankhead. I'm also running for U.S. Senate. I'm a retired lieutenant colonel and special agent. I've hunted terrorist spies and child sex predators all over the world. I'm a third generation service member, so my family has served this country going as far back as World War II. And I was raised that bullies were not okay, that the idea of someone using their power to abuse weaker folks should be absolutely offensive to us. And that's why I joined law enforcement, that's why I offered my life to serve this country. And I also did not ever see myself in politics. But with that being said, I looked at my beautiful state and my beautiful country burning, and I knew that I had something to offer. And my parents also raised me to believe that if you do have something that you can give your community to make it better, that you do that. My platform is focused on accountability, protecting the vulnerable, and affordability. I've spent my career putting bad guys in jail, including corrupt government officials. Obviously, we have the Epstein class that is ruling everything right now. I know a thing or two about putting those folks in jail and holding them accountable. But also, I am the only candidate in the race who actually has experience in and out of DC and that understands how DC works and has the trusted relationships in place. So part of my duties as a special agent was I was also a senior Pentagon bodyguard, which meant I had access to all the rooms on Capitol Hill, the White House, the most senior levels of international government. And it's those ties, the relationships, and the trust that I've built over there that we're going to use to serve Montana and get government working for you again. Thank you so much.
Michael.
My name is Michael Hummert. I'm a realist liberal Democrat. To be a realist means you have to look at the reality of life, things that our country is actually facing, not what we want it to be, not what's emotionally satisfying. But the actual reality, like a $39 trillion national debt, and Congress is doing nothing about it. Matter of fact, they do everything they can to add $2 trillion more a year to that debt. We're paying $1.2 trillion in interest alone to service that debt. That's $1.2 trillion of your hard-earned money, your great-grandchildren's hard-earned money, that has to go to pay for that service of the debt, and yet nothing's being done about it. I ask you, what else is there in Congress that they're not doing? Social Security. The trust fund is scheduled to run out of money, or I should say the trust fund is scheduled to run out of money by 2035. The first time I heard about this was the Reagan-Carter debate. And yet Congress has done nothing. You're going to take a 26% cut in your Social Security when that trust fund runs empty. And everybody paying into that trust fund that's working now is going to pay for the benefits that are being paid out. Nothing's saved for them. And Congress does nothing. That's why I'm in this race. Because it's time we actually start making some hard decisions. Do the work. And actually think about the generations to come, not just what's in it for us, but what's in it for your great-grandchildren. They deserve a future just like we had. And that is why I'm in this race. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Riley Neal, and I'm glad I got a chance to talk with so many of you in the reception before we got started here today. Congress is not doing its job. And you know how I know that? Because the people on the ground in Montana have told me. For the last year and a half, I've been on the ground all across Montana, but especially in our rural areas. And people tell us their delegates don't show up for them. In some cases, some places we go, Red Lodge, no one's seen Steve Daines in 12 years. I know, we're not surprised by that. So I've built my policy and platform and our policy and platform from Montanans. The Montanans we talk to on the ground, they tell us they want someone to block Trump's agenda. They want someone to bring about universal health care by putting their toe on the line for Montana and not giving up. People want to see minimum wage raised, and they want fair taxes on the 1%. They don't want to see a senator stand up on the Senate floor and tell folks they're going to outlaw abortion. because Montanans voted 58% for CI 128 to enshrine abortion in our Constitution. So any senator, any representative in DC who stands up and says that is not working for Montana. I will work for Montana. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are so many issues and problems that we could be talking about tonight because they need immediate attention, and I'm sure we'll hit on a lot of them even without a question from me. The first area that we're going to talk about tonight is this area of affordability. As we all know, that's sort of the umbrella of what makes people's lives happy and secure. And I'm going to focus primarily on fuel and energy costs. I'm going to focus on housing. I'm going to focus on health care and child care. So the first question, and this is going to be to you, Mr. Black Wolf, deals with fuel and energy. The cost of gas and diesel has shot through the ceiling since our war on Iran. These high costs are having and will continue to have a dramatic impact on anyone reliant on fuel to make a living or just make ends meet. It's especially having a devastating impact on our farm and ranch community. So the question is, when elected, what are your plans for lowering the high cost of fuel and stabilizing the energy marketplace?
Thank you. It's a great question to start off with. So let's be real, ladies and gentlemen. Not one of us up here as candidates has brought this problem to us. We all know who brought this current problem to us. It's this president and this administration and every single member of Congress, both Democrat and Republican, who do not have the backbone to stand up to this president. I guarantee you, when I get to the Senate, I'm going to be one of those senators that absolutely stands up to this president and this administration. The reason I can say that is because I'm not taking PAC money. I'm not taking dark money. My campaign is exactly what I say it is, and it's 100% grassroots. 100% grassroots, with the vast majority of my money coming from Montanans. I would love to take that D behind my name and get rid of it and put an M there, because I'm running as a Montanan primarily. And in order for us to fight the rising cost of fuel and affordability, we have to put this president in his place and put them and get representatives and get senators who will stand up to this administration and get prices back to where they need to be. Thank you.
Christopher.
You know, our tax code can be a really beautiful thing if we let it. We could incentivize wind development, solar development. These things would create electricity. And once we get energy onto an electrical grid, that electricity can cross state lines. It can cross markets within our own United States. We can buy and sell energy back and forth. Can't really do that with oil. Can't really do that with coal. So it's fascinating why oil and coal continue to exist in our economy. If they are dirty, if they're causing climate change and pollution, if they're causing negative health outcomes, if they're overall just more expensive and more open to exploitation now that all of us are feeling, thanks to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Yeah. Our tax code can be a beautiful thing if we let it. We can incentivize wind and solar, and we can become an electrical first nation. But we need to have some innovation and some courage to push that ahead. And we need to push back against, fight against corporate interests that want to keep gasoline stations up and running, that want to keep crude oil as the backbone of our fuel economy. We need courage. And we need to get inventive with our tax code. Thank you.
Alani.
Thank you.
So the funny thing about gas prices is I think historically we can all say it's a pretty layered and complicated decision as to how we get to our gas prices, with the exception of this year when we entered into this illegal war in Iran. So we know that there's only one person who's directly responsible for those high gas prices. So priority one is ending the illegal war in Iran. And priority two would be holding these big oil conglomerates accountable for gouging us, right? In terms of other energy realities, everybody's seeing the increase in their electric bill, right? It's gotten out of control. And that's happening because the companies that provide us with our electric are intentionally gouging us. Now, business is business, and you should make a little bit of money off of your business. However, these companies provide services so that we can live day to day. Now, we've busted monopolies in the past. We have a history in this country of taking these massive conglomerates and breaking them up because the government has a responsibility to you to ensure that it's able to provide the best possible quality of life. I have a master's degree in international relations with a national security concentration. The social contract between you and the government is you cede certain rights, like the right to kill, right, in exchange for the right to not be killed, to be protected. That's what the government offers. So we need to hold government accountable by voting the folks in out so that we can ensure that you are getting access to affordable energy commodities. Thank you.
Michael. I'm sure you've all heard that we are this massive oil exporter. It's not quite true. We do have a lot of oil that we actually developed in this country over the last 10 years. It's about 12.5 million barrels a day, and we use about 12 million barrels a day. We import 6 million barrels a day, and we actually refine that product and send it back out. And that's why they call us a major exporter. Now, of course, we're not importing as much oil right now. I want you to be clear about one thing that's very important here. We, the American people, don't own any oil. Chevron, Phillips, Exxon, these corporations that don't have the American people in their bylaws, they don't have to treat us kindly. They work on a global industry standard. We are an international supplier of oil. Now, I have a way that we can fix having wars and having oil shortages. Just simply make it illegal that you can't export any oil from the United States if we are currently in a conflict. And that will make sure that we don't get into any more conflicts, because I guarantee Exxon is not going to be happy with whoever is the president if they fire one shot and they can't export our oil anymore. Thank you.
Riley?
Thank you. I'm going to speak directly to the Montanans who have come to me in the last year and told me how hard they're struggling to put diesel into their equipment. Our farmers, our ranchers, our ag-adjacent businesses are all struggling because we did not approve this conflict, this war in Iran. No one in Congress spoke to this. No one in Congress really held the executive accountable. And we need the U.S. Senate to do its job. This is what I hear on the ground from Montanans. It's killing them. It's crushing them. These fuel prices are going to make it really hard for a lot of our ag producers to make a living. And we don't have a delegation in D.C. who cares at all. Not one bit. They won't even return phone calls to these ag producers. I know, they've told me. So if we want to make sure that we can continue to feed the world, we're going to need to use the U.S. Senate powers to hold the executive accountable and make sure it doesn't strangle and throttle our business base here in Montana, our agricultural economy. Thank you.
Okay, the next area that we're going to cover is housing. Nationally, the cost of housing has increased 60% since 2019. And in Montana, it has doubled since 2017. This forces many folks out of the single-family residency market and into the rental market, where rents remain high and are continuing to rise. This, Christopher, you will start with this, and the question is, what specific proposals do you have to resolve this continuing problem?
Yeah. Before I get to that, I want to give a shout out to state government. Yeah, we have a ballot that goes all the way down, and the big names are at the top, the sexy names are at the top, and then local districts, House districts, Senate races, those get left behind. But it's in local legislature where we can begin to move the levers of the property tax system. And, to an earlier point, our tax code can be a beautiful thing if we let it. We could increase taxation on properties within the state of Montana, second, third, fourth homes, not just another dwelling, right? The strain on additional properties can be flexed to decentivize owning too many homes, especially if you're out of state. I'm not the only one going to be up here to talk about it. I want to give a hat tip to Alani here. But getting private equity out of the housing market is also crucial. It's causing a strange imbalance in the system. That is where the federal government can step in with some regulation. We also need to use revenue to extend water lines, gas lines, sewer lines into undeveloped areas. Sometimes there's simply no way to build a property in a part of town because the utilities don't go there yet. We can use our federal tax dollars to do that as well. Thank you.
Alani?
Yes, so housing and healthcare, top two things we hear everywhere we go in the state. And when it comes to housing, there are a number of changes that we can make to make things a little bit easier for our neighbors. So because of my history in federal government, we all know it moves as slow as molasses, right? And oftentimes, as we start dealing with these really big issues, we have to start incrementally. So there are a number of small, what I call 1% adjustments that we are proposing, including obviously, removing private equity out of housing and healthcare. These are obvious things that everybody can agree on, right? They should not be monetizing our right to live freely in this country. The capital gains tax is another big one. It's a great law written in the 90s. It says that you can not pay taxes up to $250,000 on the sale of a house, but that law has not been updated since the 90s. So even if we raise that limit from $250,000 to $500,000, that would open up inventory. There are a lot of folks we've already spoken to that are really excited about selling their houses and not paying taxes because the last thing you need is to pay more tax. Same thing goes for providing incentives to construction companies and construction adjacent companies that build these houses, right? So we've talked to a number of company owners who say that taxes are their number one biggest burden. So we're proposing if your portfolio is 30% or more affordable houses, which we identify as 350,000 and below, you will start getting tax breaks to support building more affordable housing and creating win-wins for everybody. Thank you so much.
Michael.
In 1996, I retired from the United States Navy and moved to Montana. I spent 18 years remodeling people's homes. I sat across from them in the kitchen table, helping them figure out how to finance. For 18 years, I sat across from tables, people just like you. And the way they were able to remodel their houses was to take equity out, a loan against their house. It wasn't that they paid so much off on it. It was because the prices of houses keep going up. Now, it's a double-edged sword because if your house goes up, Jimbo over here can't buy it. But you don't want your house to go down so he can buy it, do you? Of course not. It's the international currency. It's called greed. So let me just say this about housing. The only way we're ever going to stabilize this nation is not by catchy gimmicks or spending more money. It's just the opposite. It's getting a balanced budget amendment to stabilize our economy so that we might one time, just one time, hit that 2% mandate that the Federal Reserve has for inflation, which I haven't seen in I don't know how many years. And every year, that inflation, it gets added on to last year's. And that's the problem we have. It's not just housing, it's inflation. And that's what we really need to work on, the core of our economy. Thank you.
Riley?
We were just in White Sulphur Springs two or three nights ago. There were about 20 people assembled there, and they were really concerned because there's about three or four houses for sale in all of White Sulphur Springs right now, and one of them is $700,000, and the other two are $500,000. That's not attainable for someone who was born, raised, went to school, maybe come back home, want to build a house near their parents, their family, or want to buy a house. It's not going to happen for them in White Sulphur Springs. At the base of this are the wages. I ran a business in Montana for over 10 years in Livingston on Main Street, a weekly newspaper. And I knew if I wanted to have solid employees who stuck around, I had to pay them fairly and give them good benefits. So we have to put some of that on us, on the business owners here in Montana, because this is an unsustainable real estate market. If we can send $1 billion a day to Iran, we can work with HUD for the relief of our veterans, our low-income families, to be able to compete in this housing market. Because otherwise, it's just simply unsustainable in Montana right now. It's desperate. So something has to be done. We're going to do it. Thank you.
Michael.
Again, beautiful question. So first thing we need to do is we need to cut out these corporate investment companies coming in and buying up single family homes as investments. Yes. And we need to put the priority on home ownership back to hardworking Montanans. Second, we do need to, Riley just mentioned it, we had a great program in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, the HUD program. We need to bring back the HUD program for people that are on fixed incomes, including tribal communities. When Ronald Reagan became the president, he essentially killed the HUD program. And what that did, and I know this for a fact, is that the tribal communities were a precursor to what is happening in Montana right now. Ronald Reagan, by cutting HUD programs that served low-income communities on all tribal nations, basically created housing deserts to this day. We're starting to see that effect happen in everywhere in all of Montana, especially rural Montana. Big cities are big towns as well. We need to get those investments back. We need to tax billionaires out of existence, and we need to reinvest those funds into programs such as HUD that will get hardworking Montanans back into homes. Thank you.
Okay, the next area is related to healthcare. Our healthcare system is under increasing pressure from massive government cuts to critical safety net programs such as Medicaid, Medicare, and Obamacare in general. Furthermore, the rising costs of medical insurance and the cost of medical care and hospital benefits is placing quality health care financially out of reach for many folks. Okay, we'll start with you, Alana. The question is, what are your specific proposals for making health care more affordable for Montanans?
Thank you so much for the question.
So, healthcare, again, the number one thing that we hear everywhere. And we are the richest country in the world, y'all. There is no reason why Americans and visitors to America should not have access to great quality healthcare using the taxpayer dollars we already spent. So, with that being said, I'm a proponent of getting up to universal healthcare. Now, that is a big ship to switch, right? So if we start for Medicaid for all, which is going to cost about $2.5 trillion a year, we can work our way up through the system. Now, when I talk to fiscal conservatives, they say, well, how are you going to pay for it? Because you Democrats always like to give everything away for free, right? And what I tell them is simple. It's the defense budget. So I'm a retired lieutenant colonel. I was the bodyguard to the Secretary of the Air Force. I understand exactly how the highest levels of the Pentagon's budget work. You probably saw a couple of months ago in the news, in September of 2025, the Pentagon spent in that month alone $91 billion on lobster tails, on baby grand pianos. That's what we call use-lose spending. Every unit gets a budget. If you don't spend it by the end of September every year, you lose what you didn't spend, you get less the next year. All Congress has to do is change that one policy to say you're not going to get penalized if you don't spend all the money, and you give that taxpayer money back, and we can use that to pay for two-thirds of Medicaid for all. And that would be the easiest way for us to start getting there. The other third of the money would come from ending the illegal war in Iran that's costing us almost $2 billion. And the best part is they can't tell me I don't know any different, because I've been there and I've seen it. Thank you so much.
Michael.
Healthcare, one of the most complicated things we're going to talk about tonight. So let's not make it sound too simple.
I'm keeping you on your toes.
It messes me up when it's in the middle of speech and it all. Like, oh, I got a whole minute and a half yet. So anyway, I digress. So let's understand the actual numbers. Healthcare is about 18% of our entire national, our entire gross domestic product. That's about $5.7 trillion. Let's not pretend the government's not in the healthcare business, because we spend $2.5 trillion on Medicaid, Medicare, ACA, Affordable Care Act, all the different agencies throughout the country, city, county, state, that have private health insurance, all these different things, about $2.5 trillion. So we're already halfway there. The vast majority of the money spent on Medicaid is spent on long-term health care for elderly and hospitalization. Just a small fraction is doctor visits to keep people healthy. It's about $6,700 for an average person on Medicaid a year. I'm sure everybody would like to buy into a program that they don't have any deductible that covers dental and eyeglasses for $6,700. If we can do it for that many people that are poor, why can't we let people buy into it? That would be a better process. That way you still have control over your health care. Thank you.
Riley?
So at the social hour before this event, I met a lot of people and I asked almost every single one of them, what are you doing for healthcare? And in this auditorium right now, we have a lot of people who don't have a choice. They're aged out from their family's plan. They're not able to invest because the cost of living's too high in other areas. First thing we could do is we can expand the age that you can stay on your family insurance. That's one line of code. Change it from 26 to 35. That would be a huge change, because it will avoid the cliff at 26 years old that a lot of our young folks who want to buy houses, who want to start families, they can't, because they got to think about health care or they've got to sacrifice health care. So that's a start. But what we need to do is basic universal healthcare, single-payer system. That's what Montanans tell me they want to see, whether they're Republican, Democrat, or not even political. 77,000 people lost their healthcare in Montana with this implosion, explosion of the ACA. And we need to not only bring those people back online, to have health care across this big state, this rural state, but we also need to offer them something better, like universal health care. Thank you.
Michael.
So when we're talking about health care is one of our fundamental human rights. And I fully understand, being born and raised in Montana, being born and raised in the United States, that we are a capitalistic society. We have a capitalistic government. However, it's just fundamentally and morally wrong to put a price tag on certain things. Putting a price tag on our health is one of those things we should not do. That is a fundamental human right. And how do we take care of that? Medicare for all, Medicaid for all, universal health care. It's simple as that. Vast majority of that annual budget that Michael Hummert was talking about, almost half of it goes to paying insurance companies to implement all of our health care programs that we have. We just need to simply reform Medicare for all, Medicaid for all, universal health care, whatever we want to call it. Cut out the middleman, invest all that money where it needs to go, and that is in each and every single one of you, and making sure each and every single one of you as Montanans have full 100% health care coverage to take care of all of your health needs, no matter what they are. Thank you.
Christopher.
I think it's always interesting to do like a temperature check, a reality check. Is it an American system going wrong or a capitalist system going right? Right? And we were all sold kind of a false bill of goods in this and plenty other sectors where the private industry would simplify things and make things better for the average citizen. Instead, I don't know about y'all, but I am stuck in a labyrinth of in-network, out-of-network. Did I look at my physician the right way and suddenly I'm being coded for five things I wasn't expecting? Right? If it's a capitalist system going right, then the only solution is some kind of a socialized answer, and that is basic universal health care. That is a single-payer system. I was in France in 2019. I work in theater. It was a theater school. It was international. We can talk about that in the other room. Another American there, Marguerite, she came down with a horrible, horrible sinus infection. She needed to go to a hospital. She was understandably afraid about what that would mean in a foreign country, in a country that she did not have currency in. They saw her free of charge. I was there during 2020, during COVID. I got free testing anytime I wanted it. It is humane, it is a basic human right, and it's Byzantine that we don't have it. Thank you.
You are listening to KGVM Bozeman, presenting a forum featuring Democratic candidates for U.S. Senate, which took place on May 7th, 2026.
Okay, the next area we're going to look at, it relates to child care. In order for families to make ends meet, both parents usually need to work. We all know people who are in that situation. And for those with preschool children, the cost of child care is not only very expensive, but in many cases, out of reach of some folks. So we'll start with you this time, Michael. And the question is, what plans do you have for making child care more affordable for Montana's working families?
Back in 1982, when I started my family, my wife and I had to address this problem. And we decided that childcare was so expensive that it wasn't worth her working. She would be working for like $2 an hour afterwards. And then you add up car expenses, you add up clothes, you add up all the different things that it takes to go to work. And so we decided not to have our family stressed like that. So my wife was a stay-at-home mom. Instead of paying childcare or just paying childcare, I would like to see a world where we take those funds that we've already allocated for that and send it directly to the parents and give them the opportunity to stay home and take care of their own children It's a complicated subject, but it doesn't always mean you have to take your child and put it in daycare. Another thing that we can do to fix this problem is have school year-round. It's unconscionable to think that you have to find daycare for your child that's 6 years, 7 years old so that you can go to work for 3 months out of the year. Why don't we just simply start having school year-round like so many other countries do? It's something to consider. We have to think outside the box, because what we're doing isn't working, obviously. We've been doing this for decades. So thank you.
Riley?
So I talked to Montanans. We've had, I don't know, 60, 70 roundtables around this state. When we first started having these roundtables last January, people talked to us about childcare first, before anything else, before healthcare, before housing. I remember our first round of roundtables were in Helena, and people were struggling. They wanted to see parental leave, number one. They want to see the ability for a family to be able to stay home for the first essential months of a child's life. That's so important. When I went to serve in the Montana State House, I was the only single mom of a toddler. And my son came to a lot of Saturday sessions with us and spent some time on the iPad. But finding childcare for him and paying for it was a struggle. And I know personally what it's like for working people to not be able to afford it or find it. Universal pre-K, this is what we need. Parental leave, this is what we need to build strong families and to build strong communities. And I'm going to work for that in the U.S. Senate. Thank you.
Michael.
As the richest country in the world, it's absolutely unimaginable why we are making people pay for childcare. We should not be making people pay for childcare in the United States. We have the resources, we have the time, we have the energy, and most importantly, we have the people to provide that care for our children. So if we take money and we invest it in universal pre-K childcare, what a lot of people don't talk about is that we're going to be creating a lot of jobs for those people who will take care of those babies. But also, in addition to that, we do also absolutely need the maternity leave for mothers. I would love to see like a three-month minimum maternity leave for mothers so they can spend that crucial time with their newborn babies. But if we do this, we really do have to get united behind it. Everybody has to get standing behind this. Everybody has to believe in it. And it is doable, it is obtainable, and I know that we can do it. And I think that when we take the Senate and the House back, we will be able to do a lot of things that we have been being pushed aside from by the Republicans. It's time for us to stand up and take this fight back to Republicans and start providing what needs to be done for hardworking Americans, specifically Montanans. Thank you.
Christopher.
I don't know if you caught the memo, press release from a couple years ago, but we're a more pro-life nation now. I don't think we're more pro-child. I don't think we're more pro-mother. I don't think we're more pro-family. These are things that programs like a federally mandated paternity leave, maternity leave would seek to address. Again, like Michael, like Riley said, these are critical times in an infant's life. There's also going to need to be someone who fills in for that person on the workforce. So we've already, if it's 3 months, if it's 6 months, we've opened up a whole new line of intern-like positions where folks can pad out their resumes and can get more face-to-face, more on-the-job training. Pre-K is also all about school readiness, yeah? And I think part of the boogeyman in the room, is that these programs have sought to have more of a closer return on investment. So they've become less school readiness and more school ready. Yeah? But if it's school readiness programs, that means that we have kids hitting kindergarten, first grade, second grade, more attuned emotionally, mentally, behaviorally to start their educational journey. And boy, oh boy, does that pay off in high school and in college or going to the trades.
Alani.
Well, I've been to over 80 countries, and I've been to almost every state in this country. And nobody in this world works harder than an American, and nobody in America works harder than a Montanan. And I've seen this firsthand. So the idea that, yes, we've gone to the norm of you need both parents to go to work to put a roof over the head, to put food on the table. Now, going back to what I mentioned earlier about that social contract between government and its people, we actually have a history of providing these types of social safety nets. Look at the New Deal, right? We were in the Great Depression, things weren't going well. The president at the time actually went against the wishes of his own party, and he set up things like Social Security, like food stamps, and the economy flourished as a result. We had a booming economy. So I propose we actually need the same thing for Montana families. The government should be subsidizing childcare, which not only would support families in being able to generate the income stress-free from having to worry about what they're going to do with their kids, but also we know that there is a shortage of childcare facilities here in the state because people cannot afford the wages that are required in order to put their kids in those childcare facilities. So not only does that mean that our families will have more opportunity, but there will be more business. And we know that businesses here in Montana, over 80% are small businesses. They are the backbone of our economy. And there's every study in the world that shows that when you infuse Main Street and the local economy, everybody's better off. Thank you so much.
Okay, we're going to shift away from the affordability area, and we're going to ask a few questions here about foreign policy. Many of Trump's foreign policy decisions have had and will continue to have a negative impact on our critical relationships with other countries and on our domestic economy. So I've got several questions in this area, mainly focusing on the Iranian war and tariffs. So we'll start with the Iranian war. Now, this is an issue, honestly, I didn't think we would be worried about this election cycle, but here we are. Without the consent of Congress or approval of the American people, Trump has unilaterally plunged us into another costly Middle Eastern war, the financial and economic impacts of which are not only devastating today, but will also surely last long past this election cycle. So it's sort of a two-part question. First of all, Riley, are you prepared to tighten the purse strings on this war and rein in Trump's abuse of his war powers? And in addition to that, how do you propose to restore our international credibility, especially with our allies, like NATO?
That's a tough one. Thankfully, in the U.S. Senate, we oversee treaty negotiations.
Yes.
So we do have that power. I'm just going to level with you. Our president's an idiot. He absolutely has no idea what he's doing, and he's not responsible to the American people or to the other branches of government. He simply isn't. So, first of all, we have to hold this administration completely accountable, and that means the Senate has to stand up and do their jobs and not be afraid of what that means in their committees or with their friends they've made. I served in the Montana State House. I know that's a small version of what we're talking about in D.C., but the same thing happens. People are cowardly. And right now is the time we need our U.S. senators specifically to stand up and say no to this military action. To the second part of the question, where we're talking about what do we do to restore our credibility? Well, this might take generations. And this is why I called that man an idiot. Because what he has broken and torn asunder in this country and around the world cannot be easily fixed, but it is going to take grit, determination, and courage, the courage of their convictions, for all of our U.S. senators. And when I'm there in the U.S. Senate from Montana, you can count on me to hold the administration accountable.
Michael.
Yeah, so again, absolutely. I don't think there's much I can add to Riley's statement there. What Riley said, no. No, but in all honesty, you know, irregardless of who we send to the Senate, and we will send a Democrat to the Senate this November, I guarantee you any one of us is going to stand up to this administration and this president. I know that I will. And I can honestly stand here and say that to each and every one of you right now, because I'm not beholden to anybody in Washington, D.C. I'm beholden to each and every single one of you. And I'm giving you all right now my word, I will hold this president and this administration to account for what they are doing with this illegal war. I give you my word right now. You can all sit here and say, when I'm in D.C., you can say, I was at that debate when I heard Senator Michael Blackwolf give us that promise, and he is holding his word now. And he is standing up for me as a Montanan. And that is what I'm going to do for you. Rebuilding our relationships. That one is going to be hard. I don't know how long it's going to take. But as quickly as he dismantled it, and if we have an overwhelming blue wave to take back the Senate and the House, it will make that relationship building much easier for us. I can't give you an honest answer when that will be. There's too many moving parts, too many gears to that. But if we have a strong Democratic Senate and a House that's going to put this administration in check, it'll make it that much easier to start rebuilding our relationships with the international community. Thank you.
Christopher.
So Donald Trump blew past the War Powers Resolution. Yeah? To me, that is an impeachable offense. Full stop. I am in support of reducing the War Powers Resolution down to 7 days. Because in 2026, war moves fast, and the consequences are huge. And it's not just this squint with an asterisk, military action. We have boots on the ground. We also have cyber warfare. There are so many vectors and so many definitions of war now that 60 days, 30 days, anything more than 7 days can just cause way too much havoc. Way too many things can be broken. Rebuilding our reputation with allies. This is going to be tough. It's going to be tough because we've ceded humanitarian efforts. We've dismantled USAID in the name of government efficiency. We've pulled back from the world stage in the name of isolationism, and China has been right there to fill the void. So in a lot of ways, it is going to be trust rebuilding, but also there's certain infrastructure, certain programs that are already put in place that have been paid for on the Chinese currency. So we have, to Riley's point, this idiot has massively misplayed this hand. And we are going to have to work very hard, and it's going to have to be very long and very patient before we get in the good graces of many of our allies.
Alani?
So, because of the last couple of decades that I worked in the federal government, I know that the only way to actually hold folks accountable is by taking their money away. So absolutely, we will hold the president accountable, and one of the first orders of business is to impeach him and restore the balance between the legislative house and the executive branch. Now, in terms of how we rebuild trust, So I'm a retired counterintelligence agent. I was in human intelligence. I was the person with briefcases full of money. I met with informants in secret. I got intelligence and I gave it to special operations, right? The way you rebuild trust after it's been broken is you say what you're gonna do and you show up over and over and over again in your behaviors that match what you say you're gonna do. And you let it take as long as it needs to take. Now, in terms of other things we can do to rebuild trust, there are four instruments of power. So when we talk about national security, I've been to the most senior military leadership and national security schools. We have diplomatic power, economic power, information power, military power. Military power should absolutely be the very last instrument that we use. So using the other three, using diplomacy, coming up with mutually beneficial economic systems, using information to benefit everybody and uplift the entire world. These are acts of faith that we can engage in to show people that who we are as Americans and Montanans is to be in a mutually beneficial relationship with everybody so that everybody wins. Thank you.
Michael.
Geopolitics just happens to be one of my favorite things. It's because it's so fluid. What Donald Trump has done to this nation and this world by attacking Iran is far deeper than what we're talking about right now. In 1974, we had a compact with Saudi Arabia to sell them arms and to protect them if they've ever been attacked. In exchange, they gave us the petrodollar. A country like China will have to exchange their currency for dollars to purchase oil from Saudi Arabia. This is what's at risk right now, because Saudi Arabia uses those dollars to buy our debt, and all the other Gulf countries also. This is way deeper than we don't want them to have a nuclear weapon, because now they're thoroughly convinced that they must have one, like North Korea, so that they can't be attacked again. So what Donald Trump has actually done is put our entire global financial system on a razor's edge. And he's put us in a position where we have to continue this insanity of attacking Iran and getting concessions from them. Because now we're going to have a nuclear arms race in the Middle East if he doesn't get that nuclear material away from them. This is a much graver situation than the average person understands. And therefore, it's unfortunate that we have to pursue this. If we had a Department of Defense again instead of a Department of War, and we cut the budget by 50%, maybe the next president won't have the effort or won't have the money to actually do something like this. Thank you.
Our national debt is more than $39 trillion and rising. We pay around $1 trillion per year to service this debt. If divided among all adults over 18, each of us would owe more than $140,000. So the question is, and this we'll start with you, Michael. We all have to balance our checkbooks and live within our means. So how do you propose to get control of this growing national debt and start this country back on the track of living within its means?
Thank you, that's a great question. You know, this seems like it could be a big convoluted question jumbled out this. It's really simple. I'm not even going to take up. You don't even have to start the timer. This is going to be really simple. It really is. Okay. One, we need to tax the hell out of billionaires and reinvest that money into whatever we need it to do. Right? Very simple. And the second, if we sit here and we think about what we really need to do is, you just said it, balanced budgets. We have to have a balanced budget every single year for Congress, and we need to hold ourselves responsible as senators and congressmen, Congress representatives, to make sure that we have a balanced budget every single year, every single cycle moving forward. It's as simple as that. Thank you.
Christopher.
Thank you. You know, the Red Hats say, make America great again. And then you ask, well, when was that? And they'll say, yeah. And you can take whatever year they say, whatever decade they say, and look at what the tax code was doing. Our tax code can be a beautiful thing if we let it. There were more tax brackets. They went higher. There was just more imagination and more innovation. The progressive side of our progressive tax system was surprisingly robust back when America was great again. So I propose bringing that sensibility back to our tax code. Let's have some mixture of 0% liability and 5% liability up to earners $75,000 a year. I don't know exactly. And let's introduce more and more tax brackets as we go up every $100,000. Once you hit a billion or a trillion, let's look at a wealth tax. Let's set corporate taxation at 25% or 30%. Let's bring corporate capital gains tax in line with wages and regular income. Our tax code can be beautiful if we let it. And this can be how we can begin to draw down the national debt. The money is there. I have to believe it is. Thank you.
Ilana.
Thank you. So obviously, we've had some really great points made about the tax code, and I completely agree with all of that. We need the millionaires and the billionaires to pay their fair share. But my primary platform item is accountability, and it is the legislator's job to ensure that we have a balanced budget, that we're living within our means as a country. So they need to be held accountable when they're not doing that. Anybody who's worked in the federal government or in the military understands when a government shutdown happens because Congress is not doing their job, it creates massive disruption and ripples across the board. You have folks that are running up right to the line of when the shutdown's going to happen, trying to get stuff in place so that our national security does not implode while we sit around and do nothing at home, only to hurry up and scramble once they get their act together and reopen government. I find this completely unacceptable, and they should not be getting paid. They should not be getting health care while the government is shut down. They should suffer the exact same consequences that everybody else does, because they are the ones who lead us, and they have to lead by example. Yeah, I think that's about it, so thank you so much.
Michael.
Don't set the timer this time. I can talk for an hour on this subject.
I know.
I'm the only one up here on this stage who's actually written a balanced budget amendment and posted it on my website. You can't just say, I want a balanced budget. You have to work through it. It'll take 5 years of consistent cuts to get to a balanced budget, but the effort's worth it. We'll have to cut things like Department of Defense. We'll have to cut it down to an actual Department of Defense, maybe $400 billion a year from $900 billion. We have to stop spending money that we don't have, because this is an existential threat to your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren. They can't have a future if our Congress keeps taking the easy way out and spending money that they don't have. We simply must have a balanced budget amendment. I encourage you to go to Mike from Montana and just read the white papers on it. There's also an amendment there for term limits, for age limits. There's an amendment there that will fix our election system in perpetuity, and it will get the corporate money out of our election system. There's an immigration law on my website that I took the time to write to encompass all immigration. And believe me, all these things I'm talking about are connected to that balanced budget, because we're spending $200 billion a year on immigration. It should be a net zero. I think people should be able to immigrate here, but not because you're going to support them. I know that's a tough one, and it's not emotionally satisfying, but I'm a realist, and we need to deal with reality. Thank you.
Riley?
So we just talked about Iran. We're wasting money there, sending $1 billion a day over there. That needs to end, and the Senate can end that. They have the power. We need to tax the 1%, the billionaires and the millionaires who have no idea what it's like to be a working person. And I just spoke with someone tonight who worked for the USGS, and they told me they did a lot of oversight on the money we spent. And that's the first thing I'm going to do when I get to the U.S. Senate. I'm going to the General Accounting Office, and I want to see the books. Because the United States Senate not only gets to appropriate funds and allocate funds, but it also has oversight. And just in speaking to this person this evening, they said, there is so much that was illegally done with the DOGE cuts. So if we want to balance our budget, we have to start by looking at the budget realistically. We're wasting money in Iran. We're wasting money with these cuts. And we're not taxing the millionaires and billionaires. Those are three things we can do. Thank you.
So that brings us to our closing statements, and I think we'll start at this end this time and work that way. So, Riley, would you like to give your closing statement?
Certainly. Thank you so much for moderating, and thank you to the Gallatin County Democrats and to everyone who showed up here, and especially the folks who have been here through both of the presentations. That House District 1 is very important. It's a winnable district, and I know that the individuals who sat up here tonight and spoke to you, each one of them is uniquely qualified to hold that position and to defeat the Republican. I'm going to keep traveling all around Montana. We're going to Sydney tomorrow night for a Republican candidate forum, which they're allowing me to attend. We are going to keep staying on the ground all through this election cycle through November. And I know, because I've been on the ground for 2 years, I didn't just unpack my bags here and decide to run for Senate. This is serious business. It's the business of the Montana people. And they deserve representation. And anytime we go into rural Montana, or what people might say deep red or conservative Montana, I want to assure every single person in this room, there are more people like you out there than you know. And we've met so many of them. And they will be voting Democrat, if not in the primary, in the general. And let me remind you all here in this room tonight, please vote the Democratic primary ballot. It's how we're going to win and how we're going to show them how we win. So thank you so much.
Michael.
I ran against John Tester in the primary in 2024. Probably nobody out here knew that. He handily beat me, but I learned a lesson. There was about 100,000 people voted in the primary on a Democrat ticket and 269,000 in the Republican side. They weren't all Republicans. They just wanted to tell John Tester that he had the wrong message. The vast majority of people in this state claim to be independents. Those are the people we have to appeal to. Now, we're all Democrats here, and you're going to select the Democrat that you like the most or think might actually get you the most or do the most. Everybody has their own criteria. I think we need to add into your criteria there who has the ability to actually take it to the Republicans and fight on their terms. Who has the ability to convince the independents to vote Democrat in the general election? That's what you need to be thinking about at this moment. Everybody can promise whatever they want, but the reality is that most of these promises won't be fulfilled. But there's some core principles, like a balanced budget amendment, that people can rally around. And everybody in Montana knows the federal government needs a balanced budget amendment. So I appreciate it if you'd vote for me in June, and I'll take it to the Democrats. Thank you.
Kalani.
So over my time in federal law enforcement, I've arrested hundreds, if not close to 1,000 pedophiles and child sex traffickers, and I have a 96% conviction rate in one jurisdiction. If that sounds impressive to you, the reality is that all of that got done because five people, just like you and I, cared about the community and wanted to do something different. So the benefit of running a statewide race is that you get to talk to people all over the state. And I'll tell you some themes that come up. People are fed up with all the politics and the nonsense. People want common sense legislation. You're not seeing Trump signs really hardly anywhere in the state anymore. And you can really feel things shifting. But the reason why we're gonna be okay is because of you all. Right? I mentioned, I've been all over the world, and there's no raw leadership culture that exists more strongly than here in Montana. Because of Montana values of community, hard work, common sense, family, and freedom, if you're born and raised here, this is normal to you, but this is special to the rest of the world. And it's those values that are needed in DC badly. I know Montana is going to be the inspiration because we're already doing it. Through the Montana Plan, through the Nasty Nine, through the bipartisan opposition to the sale of public lands via the Big Beautiful Bill. Montana has the seeds of inspiration and encouragement, and I look forward to representing you in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Christopher.
Thank you. Thank you for moderating tonight. Thank you for having all of us. Like I said, it was a pleasure, honor to be in front of y'all tonight. I think there's going to be a second casualty of this blue wave coming in November, right? We can all see Donald Trump, of course. We're going to make him a lame duck president. I don't know how unbruised Chuck Schumer is going to be either, yeah? I think this incoming class of Democrats are fed up with him. Again, I say, thank you. I say, is it an American system going wrong or a capitalist system going right? And a system can only be as functional, the outcomes can only be as functional as the system is. So a lot of the energy and the creativity, I think, in what we need out of our legislative branch has been held up by old ways of thinking. And hey, I said old, I'm not throwing shots at the elderly, right? Just folks that are too in love, too inured to their own power and their own ego. Folks that know how to play a media cycle where they get on the Sunday morning talk shows and they fire up a base for clicks and likes to keep you watching through the ad breaks. They're not working. Which is why ending the Senate filibuster is core to my agenda. We need to get the legislative branch legislating again, not the executive, not the judicial, so that we can hold the executive in check. I look forward to doing this for you. Thank you.
Michael.
Thank you for the moderation for tonight. Thank you, everybody, for listening to us. I really appreciate having the opportunity to be here to talk to you all. Two things to start off with. I ran out of time earlier. Another reason why I'm in this race is because the people I'm talking to, you hardworking Montanans, everything that is going on in this country right now is not working for you. It's as simple as that. Number two, people ask me, what's the first thing that I would do if I become the next United States Senator? That answer is simple as well. I'm going to put a stop to the chaos. Too much chaos going on right now. The reason why I think that I would make the best candidate for United States Senate, and there's two things we didn't get to talk about tonight. First and foremost is I am the only candidate for United States Senate right now that unequivocally and fully 100% understands the trust responsibility that the United States government has to tribal nations in this country. I was born and raised and I live what it takes to work with tribal nations inside and out. Although I have never been second, although I have never been in any elective office, for the past 12 years, I served as the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for my Fort Belknap Indian community. And basically what that does is that mandates federal agencies in states that have a that our tribes, the Assiniboine and Grovon tribe, have a vested interest in, and that's 12 states in the United States. All federal agencies, all state agencies have to consult with our tribal nations, and I am that designated person for the past 12 years that these government agencies, these state agencies, had to consult with me when it came to land management issues. So I have 12 years of experience working with federal and state agencies, working, cooperating, and oftentimes coming to tough decisions. And so even though I've never served a public office before, I absolutely have what it takes to be your next United States Senator. And if you guys give me the honor, I will absolutely prove to each and every one of you, you guys made the right choice when it comes June 2nd. Thank you.
Well, that concludes the evening, and thank you all again for coming here and sharing your thoughts and ideas.
You have been listening to KGVM Bozeman, presenting a forum featuring Democratic candidates for U.S. Senate, which took place on May 7th, 2026.